Welcome to today's edition of the Exploring Mining Podcast, featuring stock news from TSX, TSXV, CSE, ASX, NASDAQ, and New York Stock Exchange mining companies, plus interviews with CEOs and leading experts.
Gwen, thanks for joining us today on our show. I'm sure most of our following knows you very well and your background, but for listeners that might be new to mining, can you give us a quick overview of your background and how you started the Resource Maven?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I love being able to speak to some new audiences, so thanks for having me on. My background education-wise is chemistry and then journalism, a master's in journalism. And after I finished that, I ended up working for the Northern Miner, which is a newspaper that's all about global mineral exploration and development. When I started there, I didn't know anything about geology, about the stock market, about anything to do with this industry. But the great thing about being a journalist is that your job is to ask questions until you understand. And so that's what I did for 5 years. And those were 5 years that were pretty dynamic in the space. I started there in 2007. So there was a hot, hot year. Then there was the great financial crisis in 2009, and then there was a couple more years of bull market, sort of the 2010-11 years, and then, you know, into the downturn. It was actually 5 years out of a 7-year period. In the middle, I had taken a bit of time away from the Northern Miner, and I was a ghostwriter for another newsletter writer, so that's what gave me a window into what newsletter writing was. And so that's where I learned the craft. That's where I learned how to talk about resources, how to, you know, and what I needed to know to assess mineral projects and stocks. So then when 2014 rolled around, I was at the Northern Miner, and I realized that this mining market was going to bottom at some point, and I wanted to be more actively positioned and a more dynamic player when it turned back up. So I quit my job and started Resource Maven, and Resource Maven is where I write a weekly newsletter about what I am buying, selling, and thinking in the metals and mining space. That's the Maven letter. And then more recently, my colleague Peter, who writes Silver Stock Investor, he and I collaborate now on another newsletter, which is called Evergreen Investing, which is about the inputs and innovations that are needed for the green transition. So it's how investors can establish low-risk exposure to the huge shifts that are needed, the huge things that are needed for the green transition. That transition's a little bit on pause right now just because of economic uncertainty, lack of growth, people focused elsewhere. But when it gets back underway, there's huge gaps in needs ahead that I think will create some pretty fantastic investment opportunities. So that's me.
So I wanted to start the talk off with gold. We're now seeing gold at its weekly high again with the geopolitical tensions in the Middle East. Can you go over some of the macros that you've already seen in play with gold prices this year and how you see maybe the next couple months of this year playing out?
Yes. I mean, looking back, I can do with ease. Looking forward, a little bit more challenging, but I'll do my best. I mean, the big story with gold, the thing about gold that stands out to me in 2023 is what it hasn't done, which is it has not fallen with rising real rates. And I think that's really significant to note. So real rates, interest rates minus inflation, have ramped up, you know, since the rate hike cycle started, you know, almost 2 years ago now. And you know, real rates increased significantly this year. And they continue to rise now because of this crazy situation in the bond market where yields keep rising. So real rates keep going higher and higher. Gold is very closely correlated, inversely correlated with real rates. So usually when real rates rise, gold falls. But gold did not do that this year. Gold held its ground. Yes, it has vacillated. It's, you know, gone and touched $1,800. It's shot up above $2,000. So it's moved within a range, but it has stuck in that range. It has not fallen. If you look at a classic chart that is gold and then real rates inverted, usually they're right side by side, best of friends, tightly together. And in 2023, they have diverged. Now, the big question there is what's going to bring them back together again? A long-term pairing like that doesn't just end. And so I think the reason that gold has done so well in 2023 is because central banks are buying a lot of gold. And they're doing that because of all of the macro forces that are going on in the world right now, de-dollarization and de-globalization. I mean, de-dollarization is this sort of arm wave, was for a long time a sort of really slow, fairly arm wavy concept that, like, at some point the world is going to move away from the dollar and that will be terrible for the United States. But in the last 2 years, it has become much more real. The clear lines of allegiance in the BRICS nations, their clear decisions to actively move away from the U.S. dollar, the China actively reducing its treasury holdings and not buying much more, Russia, of course, not caring much to have U.S. currency in its hands. These are big, big shifts, and they are... As you can't just walk away from a reserve currency, you have to walk towards a different reserve currency, right? So there's different machinations in play to figure out what that will be, but gold plays a role. I'm not saying that the BRICS nations of the world are suddenly going to have gold as their main, you know, mechanism of trade, but I am saying that a lot of nations are establishing or growing their gold reserves as that backstop. If things are going to change, if things are going to shift, if new mechanisms are going to be needed, gold is the backstop. Gold is what can help carry them through the uncertainty. It can backstop the new thing, whatever it is. And so if you look at some of the World Gold Council, you know, releases, what I think is really interesting is not only has central bank gold buying really increased in 2023 and 2022 as well, but undisclosed central bank gold buying has shot through the roof. So the World Gold Council always knows which central banks are doing the buying, but a central bank is allowed to say, yes, you can say that I did the buy, or a central bank can say, no, do not say that I am the one who did the buy. And the number of undisclosed central bank gold buys is just multiplied. So that is very clear evidence to me that a whole bunch of nations out there are slowly but significantly accumulating gold as their backstop, as all of these shifting waters keep moving. And that has played an enormous role in supporting the price of gold. Okay, so that's sort of what's been happening. Where are we going from here? I'm not sure. You know, real rates haven't been a great guide for gold so far in 2023. That's what I started this answer with. I think it's reasonable to presume that real rates have peaked. Inflation is probably heading down. Maybe it gets stuck where it is, but importantly, it is unlikely that interest rates are going much higher. Another hike at this point is possible, but more than one small hike, I think, is unlikely. And there are a lot of flashing signs out there that suggest recession is more of a concern than we might like. So I don't think real rates are going any higher. So that hindrance is, I think, not in play. I think that the catalyst for gold will be either things getting worse, so a recession hitting, or the United States actually executing a soft landing and getting into a position of comfortable growth, and then gold participating in a broad metals bull market. There's lots of reasons to believe other metals need to have a bull market because they are dramatically undersupplied. I'm sure we're going to talk about that more in a moment. But gold usually participates alongside a metals bull market. So that second option, the broad metals bull market, probably takes a little longer to get going because we need some confidence that we're in a growth scenario, and not just in the United States, but, you know, that global growth is on the upswing for that broad metals bull market to get underway. That would carry gold higher. If that's the path, we might need some patience yet. If it's a recession that kicks gold higher, then that could happen, of course, at any time. Either way, November and December are rarely good months for gold, so I'm sorry to say I'm not optimistic about gold in the next 2 months. But then there's always the geopolitics, like you say, and I mean this renewed intense conflict in Gaza is significant. It is boosting gold prices because of the conflict itself, but of course because of the concern of what might come more broadly from that conflict. Those are the things that you can't predict, right? Nobody knew that that was going to happen. So there's always outlier events that can boost the price of gold. But barring such events, I don't really think that gold is going to do a dramatic anything this year, like I say, barring outside events. But I'm not sure what 2024 might bring, especially if we hit a recession. Gold loves a recession. Or if we manage to skip that and step forward into a growth scenario.
A lot of those topics, I was just at the Metals Investor Forum, which you were at as well. Just wanted to briefly talk about some of the juniors in the gold space. For one of your panels, I found Cascadia, one of the most interesting stories with you. I'd love to hear a couple of the junior stories that you really like to share with our following.
Yeah, I will certainly talk about Cascadia. So just as a bit of a setting the scene, since I don't have a lot of confidence that we're going to get sort of a rising tide in the metals market in the next little while, it's going to happen at some point, but I don't really see, I don't have confidence that that's going to happen starting tomorrow. I have different tactics that I use to try and find gains when the overall market isn't just sort of handing them out to me, which is certainly where we're sitting today. And one of those is leaning into discoveries. Discoveries can generate incredible share price returns regardless of the markets, right? We've seen that time and again. If you get a really good gold discovery, copper discovery, whatever it might be, that discovery can soar even when the overall metals markets are weak. And so Cascadia is a good example of that. So Cascadia is a company, it's a brand new company. It was spun out of another company called ATAC that was taken over for ATAC's main project. In the last few years, ATAC had started looking away from that main project, which is a gold project in a bit of an isolated part of Yukon. And they started looking at copper. They just thought that copper, they liked the fundamentals for copper going forward, and they had a concept that came to them from a prospector about the potential to find some good copper porphyry deposits in Yukon. Now, what's interesting is this kind of copper porphyry deposit, it's usually copper and gold, there's a bunch of them in the Stikine terrain. A terrain is a big chunk of rock. The Stikine terrain extends up through sort of the center, north, running north-south up the center of British Columbia. And there's some really significant copper-gold porphyries in that terrain. The Red Chris mine is the prime example thereof. Good porphyry near surface becomes a phenomenal porphyry at depth, great gold grades, good copper, very economic mine. So the Stikine is a great hunting ground for porphyries, but the Stikine in BC has been looked over pretty closely because everybody wanted to find the next Red Chris. What this prospector in Yukon realized is that nobody had really looked at the Stikine terrain in Yukon. It pinches a little bit, but then swells again, and there is a significant chunk of Stikine north of that BC-Yukon border. So this guy went out and just started looking, and he looked, we think of Yukon as being very explored because there has been so much gold exploration up there. Interestingly, in this particular part, there's been very little exploration. A little bit hard to land a helicopter or just walk through the bush, the trees are tight, that kind of thing. Maybe that was part of the rationale. There isn't a lot of placer gold in the creek, so that probably also didn't draw prospectors to the area, which is one of the common reasons prospectors look around in Yukon. Anyways, there's almost no record of any mineral claims in this part of Yukon. And he walked out there and he found blue rocks and copper sulfide minerals just stick it out of the ground everywhere. It's really quite amazing. So he staked the ground and talked to the guys at ATAC, and they bought the properties, and now they have drilled them. And so they're waiting for results from that first drill program into the first such project. They drilled right into what looks like some nice copper porphyry mineralization. It's very hard to know with copper porphyries what they're going to get out of that. I mean, I'm optimistic that they're going to get some good numbers. If the rock out of the ground, the assays from that say that they're right in this theory that there are copper porphyry, that there's good copper gold porphyry potential in this part of Yukon, they're ready to jump on a bunch of other similar targets in that same area. So they've been traipsing all through that section of Yukon looking for other areas where there's blue rocks sticking out of the ground. and they're ready to sort of jump on those, assuming that the numbers come back in support of that theory. And so that, those numbers should be back pretty soon. They wrapped up drilling a couple weeks ago, so I feel like those numbers will probably hit the market in a couple weeks. So that's an interesting one to watch. Cascadia Minerals, CAM on the Venture Exchange is the company. Discovery story, and like I say, that's the kind of story that if they do discover a new, interesting, good-looking copper-gold porphyry, that kind of thing can work, can send a share price really moving, even though the overall market is not supportive. Similar, some other discovery, I'll keep the other stories a little shorter, but some other discovery stories that I'm really interested in right now, Black Wolf, copper and gold, BWCG, Black Wolf, copper, gold. It's hard for me to get those out of that way. that on the Venture, they are also a discovery story. So they have, over the summer, they drilled two projects near Stewart, BC. One happens to be on the Alaska side of the border, but right there near Stewart, and the other one on the BC side of the border. They both are really awesome targets. One of them is like a very steep cliffside where you can see mineral, high-grade gold, silver veins sticking out of the cliff, and so they stepped back from the edge of the cliff and drilled down to target those veins. Never been drilled before. Another one is an area that had seen some drilling a couple years ago, from a company that didn't really have the financial capacity to follow through on it. And so one or two really good hits just got forgotten. And Black Wolf got that project by merging with that company, reinterpreted the ground. The Black Wolf team is very intimately familiar with the rocks around Stewart. They're experts in that area. So they reinterpreted, you know, they have a new take on that project. They basically turned the drills a different direction and drilled similar areas. And they have reported visible gold, quite a bit of visible gold in core from that Harry project. So another really interesting discovery-primed story there. Pretty inexpensive stock. It's 22 cents. Reasonably tight share float. I don't remember exactly what it is. I want to say 60 million, but I could be wrong. And waiting for results. Those results, I think, will start coming out in about 2 or 3 weeks. So Cascadia, Black Wolf, those are two discovery stories that I'm really interested to see whether they can deliver some excitement into an otherwise boring market.
Well, thank you for that. I love your picks. So those are great. Cascadia was definitely one of the ones that piqued my interest the most. So I want to switch gears here a little bit and switch over to your evergreen investing. Let's talk for investors that are looking to get into the energy transition, kind of what you're seeing in that space right now.
Absolutely. So evergreen investing is about the inputs and innovations that are needed to make the global green transition happen. So we cover several different arenas. You know, there's agri-food, there's sort of recycling and waste management. Those are two areas that Peter covers. My areas are energy, green energy, green metals, and carbon credits. Carbon credits have definitely been going through some growing pains of late. There was basically a scandal about carbon credits not being robust, sufficiently verified and monitored. And so, like I say, carbon credits are going through a growing pains right now. They will, I believe, become part of the green transition. There's no rush to invest in those at this point because they need to get through this. They need to answer some of the questions that were raised before they become accepted again. But green energy and green metals, there's more than enough opportunity there to focus on in the meantime. So on the metals front, you know, we have immense supply gaps, really significant supply gaps for a bunch of green metals. And green metals run the gamut from tiny market metals like, you know, vanadium or niobium, you know, rare earth things or small market items through to the biggest metals, some of the biggest metals markets in the world, like copper. Copper is incredibly important to the green transition, and we are absolutely coming up against a copper supply deficit in the next few years. Why is that happening? It's a pretty straightforward story. Since the last metals bull market, which ended, call it 2012, 2011, there has been an incredible cutback in looking for new deposits and building new mines. That cutback is for three reasons. Investors have not cared about metals. There was a bear market. They found opportunity elsewhere. Investors have not been interested in investing in metals. So that's one reason. The second is that management teams decided to be conservative. Investors didn't care. Metal prices were down for quite a while. They decided to be conservative, focus on profit and share buybacks and dividends and things like that. And so that means that they did not build, their focus was not on building new mines. And the third reason is that it's really hard to build a new mine. Permitting gets slower and harder every year, so it's very hard to build a new mine. All similar rationale applies to advancing projects, whether that's looking for new discoveries, taking a discovery through all of the effort needed to turn it into a mine plan. That also has not been happening anywhere near to the same extent that it did before the metals markets turned down over a decade ago. Put that all together, the thing is, and we don't have enough mines, the thing is, resource industries need sustained intense capital investment just to maintain output. If you stop investing, output declines. And that is the situation that we're coming up against with silver, with nickel, with zinc, with silver, with uranium, all of them. The output is declining. At the same time, green demand means that the need for those metals is going up, in some cases dramatically. I mean, nickel, for example, has for many, many years been a stainless steel story, a very important metal, but used primarily in terms of its market. Most of it went into stainless steel. Now, nickel is used in almost every lithium battery out there. And so this is a sea change in the nickel market. The nickel market is increasing something like 60% over a 10-year period because of this battery demand. That's huge. And guess what? There aren't the new nickel projects and nickel mines to meet that demand. So that's the overall story for green metals. Is it playing out right now? Is there opportunity? Is there profit being made by investing in green metals right now? Not right in this moment, because right now investors are not focused on growth. And green growth is a growth story. And so we need to get into a position, into a moment when investors are generally looking ahead and seeing growth, global economic growth, and are positioning for growth. Within that moment, green growth is going to get a huge spotlight on it, because that is how we now grow. And we are missing the components to feed that growth, and metals is a big part of them. So that moment will come. I don't know whether it's going to come in 6 months, in a year, in 18 months, because we need to get through the question that's up in our face right now, such as, you know, is China going to go into a recession? Is Europe going to go into a recession? Is America going to go into a recession? Is anybody going to manage a soft landing? How are we going to get out of, how are we going to survive these rate hike cycles? What's actually going to happen? Once we get through that question and get into a growth paradigm, I really do think that metals will come to the fore, because they're needed for growth and there's nowhere near enough. On the energy side of the green needs story, we're already seeing one component therein start to soar, and that's uranium. So in the green energy side of things, there's lots of various opportunities out there. The one that I'm focused on is uranium, nuclear energy, and that's because I really understand that space, and I know that it fits all of those supply-demand characteristics that I just spelled out. The uranium story has been slightly different. There was particular reasons why we are very short on uranium right now. But the bottom line is that we are very short on uranium right now. So the copper story, the zinc story, the nickel story, the silver story, those stocks, those metal prices haven't started to move because we're not facing shortage today. Users who need copper or silver can find it. When they go out to buy it, it's available. On the uranium side of things, when users go out to buy uranium today, they cannot find it, or they have to pay quite a premium, a rising spot price, to get their hands on uranium today. Uranium is leading the charge on the shortage side of things, and we are at the supply deficit now. And that's why the price of uranium has risen from whatever it is, $48 to $72 in the last few months. Uranium stocks have absolutely provided leverage to that move. And I don't think we're done, because you can't suddenly produce new uranium mines. You can't turn them on quickly. Even all of the companies, the half dozen companies who have been slogging away for the last 5 or 6 years to get uranium mines ready to produce into the supply gap. Very few of them were even ready, because it's such a slow process to get a uranium mine going, whichever kind of uranium mine it is. So there's no quick answer. There is not uranium out there that for the users that need it, and the users are nuclear utilities who will pay whatever they need to pay to get their hands on the fuel that they need for the nuclear reactors, because it's not a choice for them, that's a need. And so the uranium story is playing out right now. It's taken a bit of a pause after a huge price run in these past few months. I think it's consolidating those gains. I do think that there's more upside ahead, significantly more upside ahead, because unless you can suddenly find a whole bunch of uranium to feed into the supply gap that exists right now, prices will go higher. They will also go higher because the users are scrambling to get buy pounds today, but they also don't want to continue to be in that scramble. So they are signing long-term contracts. And the sellers of uranium, the miners, are saying, sure, I'll sign a long-term contract for you, with you, but you're going to have to pay me a lot for that uranium, because it is now a seller's market. So contract prices are going to go higher and higher and higher, because those uranium miners, they need higher prices so that they can pay to build the new mines that will eventually fix this problem. So all of the pieces are really in play in the uranium space for the kind of bull market that we will see in the base metals. We're just not quite there yet with the base metals, but we are there with uranium. There, that was a long answer.
I love it. And uranium investors are going to be very happy to hear you say that. Going back to your nickel story, the second other company that I loved for your panel was Alaska Energy Metals. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about them, because I think they're actually a really exciting story once you kind of get into realizing what they do and the potential there. And then also, if you're, since you talk so much about uranium, if you have one that you also love for that, do share.
Absolutely. Yeah, Alaska Energy Metals is a really great story. So this is a technical team that has a lot of experience in Alaska, long experience in Alaska. The leader of that company, a guy named Greg Beischer, came up against the opportunity to buy the Nikolai project. And this is a project that he had drilled 30 years ago, 40 years ago, I don't remember the number, working for a major. At the time, the goal was to find sort of a huge high-grade nickel deposit. So they went up. They drilled a bunch of holes. They did not find a huge high-grade nickel deposit, but they did find a big area of low-grade nickel mineralization. Now, 30 years ago, that was not economically viable, so they walked away. Fast forward 30 years, Greg gets his hands on this project, and now that nickel mineralization is absolutely within the very normal bounds of economic nickel deposits. And so the opportunity is really amazingly simple. The work that was done previously has outlined a significant, I don't remember the length of the zone. I don't remember the dimensions offhand, but the work that was done has shown that there is consistent nickel sulfide mineralization across a long strike length. I think it's like a couple of kilometers. There's been not enough drilling to define a deposit, right? You have to have drilling, enough drill holes to have confidence to actually call it a deposit. So Alaska Energy Metals went up there this summer and drilled enough holes in the center section of that known zone to turn that into a deposit. Those assays are pending, but because the historic holes were so consistent, they just kept stuffing 300 meters, 300 meters, 300 meters, and getting the same thing. The team is pretty confident and that the holes that they pulled out of the ground this summer, which look exactly the way that they expected them to look, will also return those same nickel grades. That means that by the time these results come in, they expect to be able to define a significant nickel sulfide deposit in the middle of that zone. guess what? They're going to repeat the process next summer. They're just going to keep stepping each way along that known nickel zone and expand the deposit even farther. So it's really a low risk and rapid way of defining a large nickel sulfide deposit. And there's a few other factors here that deserve mention. So it's in Alaska, but it's in a very permittable part of Alaska with pretty good access. So that's important. By permittable, I mean it's not near any salmon-bearing streams. It's near Alaska Native corporations who are transactional and interested in doing this sort of business. So permittable area of Alaska, pretty good access. And nickel sulfide. So let me just quickly, I mentioned before we need a lot more nickel than we used to because of batteries. There's two kinds of nickel out there in the rocks of the world. There's nickel laterite and there's nickel sulfide. Nickel laterite is often mined in places like Indonesia. It is mostly strip mining. It's soft rocks that are near surface. So you strip mine, you scrape a bunch of rock off the surface of the earth, and then you have to use a very significant amount of energy to liberate the nickel from the mineral that it is within. The reason that matters is because we're supposed to be mining nickel so that we can make batteries, so that we can have less greenhouse gas emissions. But the amount of energy that you need to liberate nickel from nickel laterites goes exactly against that. So nickel laterites are problematic. They are part of the nickel picture for sure, but they're problematic. Nickel sulfide deposits, you do not need to do that super energy intensive step to liberate the nickel from the mineral. It depends a bit on the details of the mineral. The initial studies of the Nikolai project show that the harder minerals for liberating the nickel are not dominant. The dominant minerals at Nikolai are the ones where it's pretty easy to liberate the nickel. So you have a nickel sulfide project, which is the kind of project that battery makers should want to get their nickel from. It looks like there's a very clear path, not very expensive, pretty low risk, to defining a very large nickel sulfide deposit in an area that looks like it could be, you know, reasonably easy to permit and build a mine. So, and this is new. This is a story that really just came together at the beginning of the year. Hasn't really gathered a lot of momentum yet. So, if you're interested in nickel, then Alaska Energy Metals, AEMC, is the ticker for that on the Venture Exchange. On the uranium front, I'll give a few options. And I say, I really think that there's a lot of upside in uranium. For any mining investors who are looking for some excitement in the near term, I think uranium is likely the thing, the most reliable way to do that. With uranium, you could always just own something like the URNM, which is the basket of uranium miners. That will work great. That's an easy choice. You can also, but if you're looking for something that's a little bit more pointy, so a little bit higher risk but potential for higher reward, I think the stories that are best positioned to benefit from this uranium market are two kinds. One are the companies that are ready to start producing into the supply gap. And so these are the companies that have been grinding away for a bunch of years, permitting and doing, a lot of the ones that have been doing this are ISR, so the ISR mining, in-situ recovery. So this is the kind where you pump a solution down into rocks that are porous, so the water can move around through the rocks, leach out the uranium, and then you just pump the water back up to the surface. It's in situ. You don't actually dig the rock up. Uranium is quite amenable to that. It often exists in sandstone, which means the water can move through it. And there's a couple different companies that have been preparing, doing all the work, the well monitoring and the flow tests and the permitting and whatnot, to get ISR uranium mines in America going again. The two names that I really like in that are Uranium Energy, UEC, in New York, and Energy Fuels, EFR, on the Venture. It's also in America. I don't remember the American ticker right now. And also Encore Energy, which is EU. So those three I really like for their ability to very soon start producing into the supply gap that is real right now and is the reason that uranium prices are rising. So I think that's one kind of stock that will do very well in this uranium market. I think the other kind of stock that will do well are those that own really, really good uranium projects. And there's not that many out there. I mean, NextGen, which has the Arrow project, is certainly on that list. NextGen will get built in this uranium market. Will NextGen build it or will somebody else buy it and build it? I don't know the answer to that, but both are very feasible. When real big money starts turning into uranium because the market is really working, NextGen will be one of the key stocks to which that money flows because it's big, it's liquid, but it has that little bit of extra leverage because it's a development project instead of being a producer. So NextGen and XE is a good one. And then a cool one is two companies have recently decided to merge, and their combination is creating what I would call like an Uber Uranium Junior. So this is a Uranium Junior that has a whole bunch of projects from pre-discovery, but all the way through to almost ready to produce and everything in between. And it has very good financial backing. So NextGen actually owns a bunch of ISO. They are investing in this merged entity. There's two other larger uranium companies that also are shareholders in this merged entity. And so it's going to have good access to capital. That money means that it will be able to advance its whole portfolio of projects. And that just means that any major that decides that they want to get into uranium will have to look at the new, and actually I don't remember which one it's going to be called. The company is a merger of Consolidated Uranium and ISO Energy. I, at this moment, can't remember whether they're going to end up calling it Consolidated or ISO, to be honest. But that merger, I think, is really interesting. It's still brand new. Was announced a couple weeks ago. It won't actually happen for another 2 months. They need to get shareholder approval and all of that. But I think that that is going to be another go-to stock when this uranium bull market really starts to gather momentum.
I wanted to talk more about you now. For investors that are looking for guidance, let's talk about your newsletters, what you offer, how they can join, any of the upcoming conferences that they can listen to you at and see more of your panels, where they can follow you on social media. Give us the whole spiel.
Aw, thank you for the opportunity for that. So resourcemaven.ca is my center of operations. That is where you can find out more about or sign up for my newsletters. Of course, I have that weekly Maven letter, which is about what I'm buying, selling, and thinking in the metals and mining space. It's more focused on the speculative end of the space, so discoveries and the smaller cap companies in the metals and mining space, but not exclusively. I certainly also have mine builders and a few operators in there. So that's the Maven letter at resourcemaven.ca. The letter that I co-author with Peter is Evergreen Investing. You can get to it from resourcemaven.ca, or you can go to it from evergreeninvesting.com. That is a monthly newsletter. It's designed for low-risk investors. So it's got funds in it. It's got big companies, but it is establishing exposure to those inputs and innovations that are going to need to be, you know, see higher prices as we get back into a growth environment. And green is a big part of that growth. As for social media and whatnot, I am active all over the place. You can find all the links again on resourcemaven.ca. Mining Maven Gwen on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm on all of those. I would. And as for conferences, I do participate in the Metals Investor Forum every time it happens. The next one is coming up in November in Vancouver. Then there's another one in January in Vancouver and one in Toronto in March. And then I'm always, you know. Oh, and I'm heading down to New Orleans. If anybody happens to be listening to this and feels inclined to head to New Orleans at the beginning of November, there's a great conference down there called the New Orleans Investment Conference. It's been the standard bearer gold conference for decades, and it's a great event. So with really phenomenal speakers. I'm not talking about myself. I'm talking about big names, big financial names that come down to speak at that event. But yes, I have an events listing on my website as well. My contact information is there. So if anybody has questions and wants to reach out and ask me anything, I would love to hear from you.
So we'll just wrap this up with one more question for the day. I mean, obviously 2023 has been an interesting year, to say the least. Do you have any final words for the investors and the juniors out there? And you got any final words for the juniors out there for their words of wisdom to end the year with?
Yeah, for sure, right? For the investors, I'm going to be a little bit cautious on my words, which are, I said before, November and December are rarely good months for metals, especially for gold, and especially when it's been a tough year. So I wouldn't get your hopes up that November and December are going to work out well. That, for the investor, might mean, you know, if you're going to do some tax loss selling, you might want to do it now rather than waiting until November, because prices are probably going to be lower then. But there's no harm getting out of something now. And then if you really like the stock, getting back into it at the end of the year when the tax loss selling has hammered it down even further. So I guess the word there is don't have high hopes for the very near term. I don't think anything very exciting is going to happen in the near term. The overall setup remains phenomenal for gold and for base metals. I just don't think it's going to play out in the latter months of this year. So think about what that means for you and your portfolio. If you're happy to just hold, that's absolutely an option because that big picture setup is still so good. If you know that you will lose sleep if you see stocks declining further over the next few months, then maybe do something to help you sleep at night, which is maybe means exiting some positions. Even if they're down, put that capital aside, because then you have it to redeploy when this investment thesis does start to play out. For the juniors out there, it will get better. I'm optimistic that 2024 is going to be a better year for sure. So just keep doing what you can do. And I mean, the undervaluation out there is extreme. The sentiment is terrible. This has to turn, and it will. And when it does, it's going to be phenomenal and exciting. And we just have to get through the down market days together.
Well, thank you so much, Gwen. This was a fantastic interview, and thank you for sharing all those amazing stories and advice for everyone out there.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It was a fun conversation.
Well, that does it for today's Exploring Mining podcast. If you'd like to be a guest or sponsor for this podcast, please contact investorideas.com. InvestorIdeas.com reminds all listeners to read our disclaimers and disclosures on the InvestorIdeas.com website. All investment involves risk, and this podcast is not meant to be an endorsement to buy or sell securities or products. To hear more podcasts, you can go to InvestorIdeas.com/audio. And a reminder, you can also hear our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, iHeart.com, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, and SoundCloud.